underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. New York Times bestselling author of The Martian, Andy Weir's new novel, Artemis, is a near-future crime caper set on the moon. Weir introduces us to Jasmine Bishara, a.k.a. Jazz. She is just another too-smart, directionless 20-something, chafing at the constraints of her small town and dreaming of a better life. Except the small town happens to be named Artemis, and it's the first and only city on the moon. When the chance at a life-changing score drops in her lap, Jazz cannot say no, even though she's sure there's more to the setup than meets the eye. And indeed, pulling off the perfect crime is just the first of Jazz's problems as she finds herself in the middle of a conspiracy for control of Artemis itself. The new novel is titled Artemis, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andy Weir to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we don't often have science fiction authors on the program. And then I was wondering as I was reading this and wondering as I was preparing for this interview of whether you would even consider this to be science fiction.
Well, I mean, it is science fiction in that it's like speculative and it's in the future. And it's kind of hard to argue that a story that takes place on the moon is not science fiction. But yeah, I tried to use realistic, real science everywhere I could. There is some made up science a little bit later in the book. But initially, it's all based on real stuff that could happen.
At what point do you give yourself that latitude that it's okay to use some makeup science?
Well, I'm okay with made up science as long as it's not physically impossible. And also, I need to keep it realistic for the era that it's in. It's like, so, you know, it takes place in the 2080s, so I shouldn't be working on, you know, near light speed propulsion. I just don't think that we'll invent that in the next 100 years. But the material that I invented, that I'm kind of talking around it because I don't want to give any spoilers.
Right.
That kind of new invention that happens during the book is plausible.
So, of course, you are known for The Martian. That book took place on Mars. This book takes place on the moon. What was it that fascinated you about the moon and wanting to explore the moon as opposed to, say, Mars again?
I wanted to write a story about humanity's first city off of Earth, and I just really think that's going to be on the moon. I think that's the most likely location it'll be. Colonizing Mars before colonizing the moon would be like if the ancient Britons colonized North America before colonizing Wales. It just doesn't make any sense. It's just the moon is so much closer and more convenient. There's no need to leapfrog over it. And it would aid in colonizing Mars if we had an infrastructure on the moon because the lower gravity well of the moon makes things easier to produce on the surface and then send to Mars. It's cheaper. So I just really think that it's the most likely place where the first non-Earth city will be. So that's where Artemis takes place.
So this fact of the moon being closer, obviously the first thing you think about is tourism and the mm-hmm. possibility of that and what ultimately gets us there and setting up a city on the moon.
Right. Well, I did a bunch of economic analysis, which I'll spare your listeners.
Thank you.
But basically, I worked out, I said, what if the commercial space industry was as efficient as the modern commercial airline industry? And I don't mean to imply that the space industry, like SpaceX and stuff, are inefficient. It's just they don't have the technologies developed yet to be as, you know, robust as the airline industry is in what they do. So I'm saying if there were infinite demand for space travel, then what would, you know, and there is market competition on making it happen, what would the price to low Earth orbit be driven down to? And once that, and I did that analysis and worked out all the math on that, and then the numbers looked good for, oh, well, then middle class people could afford to go into space, they could afford to go to the moon, and so it becomes economically viable to build a tourist destination on the moon. And so that's Artemis's economy. It's a tourist economy.
Before we move away from the comparisons of The Martian and Artemis, Did you find this to be a more difficult book to write in the sense that it's a crime story? It is a mystery.
Yeah, it was much harder to write than The Martian. The Martian was pretty straightforward because it was just problem solution, and due to the framing and diary nature and whatever, I could just go off into long bents of exposition and the reader would allow it. But for Artemis, there was a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of different people with different objectives and goals, and, you know, sometimes conflicting, sometimes aligning. And it was a much more difficult book to write and to plot out, too.
Let us talk about Jazz Bashara, and this is the character that we meet. And as I mentioned in the introduction, she is our narrator. It's a first person narration, and well, she's kind of full of it, isn't she?
Yeah, she's a very flawed character. That's another thing I'm trying to do is I got this unexpected amount of success with The Martian, but I still consider myself, I still have a lot to learn about writing, and I want to stretch myself. So I wanted to have a deeper, more interesting protagonist, one with, flaws. And Jazz is a very flawed person. She makes bad decisions. She has regrets. And even though she's extremely intelligent, she doesn't always do the smart thing. And so, yeah, and she's the first-person narrator, so I get to have this snarky attitude directly at the reader, which I enjoy writing. yeah.
There's something fun about that, I would assume.
Well, what's interesting is, so Mark Watney is the idealized version of me. He's
right.
All the qualities I have that I like about myself and none of my many, many flaws. And he's better at all the stuff I'm good at. He's what I wish I were. Jazz Bashara is really more like the real me. Flawed, bad decisions, especially in her youth. Being fairly intelligent doesn't mean you always do the right thing. She's more of the broken and not so awesome parts of me.
So to take a quick digression here, so Mark Watney, who of course is the protagonist in The Martian, when you cast Matt Damon in that role, that changes it to another level completely, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, he's a lot more handsome than I am, for starters. Of course, I didn't have, any say over casting
Sure.
or anything like that. The writer of the book has very little to do with the movie. My only job was to cash the check, but I feel like I did that very well. Once he got portrayed by a superstar, then that changes everything. And of course, he just absolutely nailed the role. I mean, he's an incredibly good actor, and he just got all the personality quirks and the kind of subtlety, but also sarcasm. And I don't know, he just did a perfect job.
Let us go back to Jazz, because as we've been talking, she is a flawed character, but she's also a very likable character, isn't she?
Well, I hope so. I know that. So I've got, hundreds of reviews have come in on Goodreads, and there is a percentage of those reviews that just did not like Jazz personally. Like, they just found her grating. But other people just love her. So I guess I didn't mean for her to be a divisive character, but I guess she accidentally is.
So this going back to an earlier point that you made of still having a lot to learn about this process, most mm-hmm. writers will tell you or say to you right now, why are you looking at those reviews?
Well, I can't prove this, but I honestly believe there are two kinds of writers. Writers who read reviews and writers who read reviews and lie and say they don't.
Yeah. Okay. I'll buy that.
Yeah. So I have a hard time believing that anybody could just not read it. Also, of course, I'll go like, okay, I'm going to read the Goodreads reviews, and I'll just skim over like 20 5-star reviews and find one that's like 3 stars and then hyper focus on it and feel bad about myself. Right. That's how writers are. What is it? They say, give a man a book and you entertain him for a night. Teach a man to write and you give him crippling self-doubt for life. So, so of course I read the reviews, but it's more than just curiosity or compulsion. It is, I am trying to hone my craft. I'm trying to get better at it. And the only way to get better is to see what people didn't like. So naturally I skim over the things that are like, hey, I loved it. It was awesome. I'm like, well, those people are satisfied. Everything they're going to talk about is stuff right. I did right. I'll look at them to see, okay, what is the stuff I should not change? Like, oh, they like this, they like this, they like this. Okay, definitely don't mess with that. But I'm trying to find, you have to kind of, don't focus on any one review, but if I read a couple, 100 of them, and I find common themes and things people didn't like, then that's something that I need to be conscious of and work on when I'm doing my next book. I want to get better, you know? I want to, everybody, you know, everybody sure. should be wanting to get better at what they do.
Strives for that. Andy yeah. Weir is with us. He is our guest in this week's book show. The name of the novel is Artemis, and it is published by Crown. We talked about the real, what we know about, what you knew about the moon, your research into the moon, but you're still creating. You're creating this city, this first city on the moon, Artemis. What was that like? How do you map that out of what this place is going to be like, what it has, what it doesn't have, and how it is going to sustain not only the people that inhabit it, but sustain the novel itself?
Well, that was the fun part. I mean, world building is always fun. I think most writers would say the same thing. It's the pesky, you know, characters and plot that are the hard part of a book. But yeah, I did all the math. Basically, I knew how much I had calculated a value for how much it cost to put mass on the moon in this era. And from there, I could say, like, okay, what's the best way to build a city on the moon? I'm like, well, you start with a couple of nuclear reactors, so you've got energy taken care of. Then you start refining the local ores into metals, and so that you can build your city out of local materials rather than, you know, spending a gajillion dollars and everything there from Earth.
Right.
And so bit by bit, it started to come together like that. And what's interesting, and I've never done this before, is I had designed the entire setting before I came up with any plot or characters, which is probably a weird way of doing things. But I was like, first, I'm going to make the city. Then I'm going to make the stuff that takes place in the city. But I wanted to have the city well-defined. I needed to kind of understand where it was taking place before I could come up with a story that takes place there.
Well, isn't that sort of just like setting the rules? I mean, what the rules are going to be
yeah.
that allows the character to do this or to do that or not to do this or not to do that?
Well, and also, yes, for sure. And also, a lot of the story is intrinsically tied to how the city functions. So, yeah, basically, I said, like, here's a city. Here's how everything works. Now, what is some, like, you know, what's some mischief that can happen?
So let us talk about where these characters live. It's basically they live in these bubbles. They're named after famous astronauts.
Yeah, and to be clear, these bubbles are aluminum double-hulled spheres on the lunar landscape that are between 1 and 200 meters across. So they're big.
Yeah, they're big. And there aren't that many of them, right?
Right. There are 5 total.
That make up the entire city. So yeah. What is the advantage of putting the characters in that kind of confinement, if you will?
Well, there's no writing advantage to it at all. It's just that's the most realistic city design that I could come up with. Basically, a sphere is the best way to hold air pressure in and minimize how much material you need to build the pressure vessel. It makes a very strong pressure vessel. That's why bubbles end up being spheres, you know, when like soap bubbles.
Right.
I figured also you want to make sure your city's kind of compartmentalized. So the spheres are big enough that an air leak, if there were an air leak, would take a long time to empty out a sphere, but small enough that you can get everybody out of that bubble and seal it off so that the rest of the city is safe and nobody dies.
And as you point out, obviously made out of aluminum, but there is a lot of aluminum on the moon.
As much as you want. Yeah, the moon is awesome in that it's really like it's sitting there just waiting for us to colonize it. About 85% of the material in the lunar highlands, which is the bumpy parts of the moon as opposed to the smooth parts. If you go to the lunar highlands and just pick up a rock off the ground, there's an 85% chance that you just picked up a piece of anorthite, which is a mineral that's made of aluminum, silicon, calcium, and oxygen. Lots of oxygen, actually. So if you refine it and smelt it, then you're separating it out into those base elements. And so just picking up anorthite, which is like extremely prevalent on the moon, it gives you aluminum to build your moon base with and oxygen to fill it up. It's like the moon is just made of moon bases with some assembly required. All we have to do is go there.
So obviously you do a lot of research to come up with the smelting process of anorthide, right? Right. I mean, you have to know
I
that.
I didn't invent it, but I did research to find out, okay, what would be a good way of doing this? And I landed on the FFC Cambridge process, which was developed in the 1990s. So it is actually fairly new technology also.
And that, then what is between to making up of being able to get from one place to the other, meaning that you can go from one bubble to the other?
Well, the bubbles are connected by tunnels that they just call connectors. And at each end of the tunnel, there's a plug door. So it's this big door. It's like several meters tall and it's round. And basically, the tunnel is never open to both bubbles at the same time. The plug doors cycle. And so it's like this one's open for 2 minutes, then that one closes and the other one's open for 2 minutes and so on. So the tunnel is, so the two bubbles are never actually directly connected at the same time. And then what happens is if there was a breach in a bubble, if there was a catastrophic breach, then just the flowing air pressure against that plug door would close it. I mean, the people inside would be dead, but the rest of the city would be saved. And that's the kind of design philosophy they have, is that they you know, air pressure is absolutely critical. Also, the hulls are double-hulled systems. It's 6 centimeters of aluminum, a meter of crushed lunar rock, which basically sand, and then another 6 centimeters of aluminum. So all of that would have to fail at the same time for there to be a leak. I decided the people who designed it would not mess around with that particular bit of safety.
But as you know it, I mean, these structures are huge, and yet it is still a confinement. It is a confined, contained city. So what is it like to put a crime and a crime novel within those confines?
Well, it's a densely populated area, but the population density is about the same as Manhattan or Tokyo. So it's not like super duper dense, but it is dense, right? And so it's just like a crime in any other major urban environment, except it's also a small town, which is kind of a weird thing, because you don't usually have a small town with high population density.
Right.
You usually have one or the other. And so this is one of those towns. There's only 2,000 permanent residents in Artemis. So it's one of those towns where kind of everybody knows each other. I mean, it's not quite Mayberry, but it's, you know, it's not a big city. And so having a crime take place there is like, well, the investigation can be, you know, sped up by the fact that the local cop knows like most of the people there. But it is slowed down by the fact that they don't have like a standing police force. They have one guy.
So I assume that it is the understanding that over time, from the time that we live in now to the late 21st century, that commercial space travel has gone wild. There is great competition, and people like you and me can actually afford to go live in Artemis.
Right. Well, it costs a lot to get there.
Yes.
Yeah, to visit. So it would cost in, like, again, I'll spare you all the math, but I came up with it would cost about $70,000 in 2015 dollars. 2015 is when I did all the math. It would cost about $70,000 to have a 2-week vacation to Artemis. So that includes a week. So it's a month that you're spending away from Earth. It takes you a week to get there. And during that time, you're basically on a nice cruise liner, effectively. It takes you a week to get there. Spend 2 weeks in Artemis and a week to get back, and that would run you $70,000. So it's not like, oh, we're going to go to, you know, Europe and tour that. No, it's much more expensive, but it's still within reach. And if you could, there are a lot of people where if they could go to the moon for 2 weeks, and you know, all they need to do is get a second mortgage on their home, that they would do that. So, and of course, the wealthy tourists,
yes,
go there all the time.
But you do get the sense that competition has driven the price down at some point, so that
absolutely
there are people of more modest means that can make the trip.
Oh, sure. Well, for the people who are emigrating, that's a different matter. Now, Artemis does it. It's not a managed economy. It's just pure. In fact, it's a completely unmanaged economy, which can cause some problems, right? But it's people going there to live there. Well, first off, it costs less to just go there if you don't need a return trip. And second off, when people are relocating their lives, they're that is a point at which you put a lot of your resources into something. Like if you're going to, you wouldn't spend, a lot of people would say like, yeah, I'd like to go to the moon, but it's not worth 70,000 bucks to me, even though I could probably swing it. I could sell my house kind of thing like that, but that's not worth it to me. However, if you're going to move there, if you're going to emigrate, then it becomes something that is worthwhile. So it's similar to, you know, the mid-1800s. You've got this Irish cobbler or something says like, I'm going to emigrate to America. I'm selling my shop. I'm selling my house. I'm selling everything I can so that I can afford to go there and start a new life.
And through this process, as the story becomes more mysterious and we look at what has to be done here, this character of Jazz is really fascinating, as you say, as it's first person. So she's telling us the story, but it's a confident narrator, isn't she? She is confident in what she's doing.
On and off.
Yeah.
She's usually fairly confident, but she's also acutely aware of a lot of her flaws. She's pretty honest with herself. But yeah, she's not like a wallflower. She's not meek. She's fairly confident in herself and sometimes maybe too confident in herself.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess that's what I mean, that you would even have the confidence to be able to question some of your failings or your infallibilities.
Yeah. She's very blunt.
You've brought that up a couple times here. Is that part of you? Do you find yourself to be blunt?
Probably more often than I should be.
So does that ever get in the way of writing, or does that let you say more of what you want to say?
It doesn't get in the way of writing. It does sometimes annoy my friends.
Well, yeah. Do you care about them? I mean, you've got movie
deals. Sure.
Well, I know you care about them, but, you know, you've got movie deals. They don't. So, you know.
Aw, that'd be a really bad attitude.
All right. I was just gauging the I don't give a, quotient.
I give a quotient.
Okay, good. When it comes to, as you mentioned, when it comes to the next thing and your progression as a novelist, do you ever see yourself moving away from this genre of moving away from space?
Not in the near term. I mean, I don't know what I'll feel like if I'm, working on my 10th book or something. I don't know. But right now, I mean, that's my... Well, it's a combination of a bunch of things. First off, it's very, very interesting to me, so I'm motivated. Second off, it's where my knowledge base is, write what you know. So if I was going to write a period drama in the 20s, I wouldn't know where to begin.
Right.
And it's also the kind of book I like to read. So, I don't foresee me sneaking out of the genre anytime. I earlier, after The Martian came out, before I wrote Artemis, people would ask me that same question. And I would say like, oh, I might want to write a crime novel someday. That might be interesting. But then I realized, hey, just because I'm writing a crime novel doesn't mean it can't be sci-fi. Boom, Artemis.
You also brought up the fact that the success of The Martian really, I assume for you, came out of nowhere.
I didn't think it would even have mainstream appeal. At the time I wrote it, I thought I was writing it for a very, very tiny percentage of hardcore dorks like myself. Mm. I had no idea that this basically a long sequence of algebra questions would actually be popular.
Well, there's a little more to it than that, isn't there?
Right, but I had no idea that, I wish I knew what I did right there. I mean, I get a lot of different answers, but ultimately there's a... It had a feel to it that people really liked.
And does that, and we talked about this, about confidence in the character, but did you feel a confidence then of taking on the next project?
I mean, it's really daunting to follow up The Martian, right?
Yeah.
I've found that the southwest corner of my home office is the best place for whimpering, but the northwest corner does get good sunlight in the morning. So, sometimes... No, but seriously, It is, there's, of course, I'm nervous. I'm nervous about it. I have to follow up The Martian, and everybody is going to compare Artemis to The Martian. And it's a different story. It's not a survival tale. It is science fiction. But other than being science fiction, that's where the similarities end. So people will be comparing it to The Martian and kind of not really seeing much in common. And So all I can do is hope that people like it.
Well, it's a very enjoyable novel. It is entitled Artemis. It is out from Crown. Andy Weir, I thank you very much for spending time with us. It's a great pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.